Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Beyond the Book. It is Friday, October 30th, 2020. Every week we check in with Publishers Weekly for the latest news and analysis on books and publishing. Andrew Albanese, PW Senior Writer, joins me today. Welcome back to the program, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
So in a year when we could always use some good news, that's how we will start today's program. PW's Best Books for 2020 is out.
Yes, and good news indeed. The list dropped last Friday. It's been all over the news. You've probably seen it advertised in a few places or picked up in the media. Best Books is probably Publishers Weekly's most popular and important feature. You know, it collects the picks of our reviews team, who review over 9,000 books a year. And it's always just a great eclectic list. And it kind of kicks off the season of best of list that you're going to start seeing coming from a number of outlets now. And, you know, I just have to shout out our reviews team and our reviews editor, Johnny Segura, because to put it mildly, 2020 has not been a normal year. But you wouldn't know that looking at this best of list. It looks like any other year. It's just filled with great books. But readers should know that this list was compiled amid tremendous difficulty, right? There were no meetings, and discussions were all done over Zoom and Slack and email. And many of these books were delivered via eGalley because our offices are not fully operational at this point. It was a challenge for two things. There was no shortage of excellent books published in 2020, and the hard work and professionalism of my colleagues on the reviews team, who are, in my opinion, best in the business. So there's a top 10 list, and there's deeper dives into fiction and nonfiction as poetry, as well as 50 excellent titles for children and teens. So please check that out on the Publishers Weekly site. And then, and this is important, order a book. Go pick it up at your indie bookstore, maybe two books. Hey, the holidays are nearly here. Why not get an early jump on your shopping?
Well, indeed, it is an impressive and very diverse list, Andrew. Tell us about the author featured on the cover of the print edition, Ayad Akhtar.
Yeah, so our readers may know Ayad Akhtar. He is a Pulitzer Prize winning playwright, and he's the incoming president of PEN America. And his novel, Homeland Elegies, just kind of blew our staff away. As our reviews editor, Johnny Segura, noted in his intro to this year's Best Books list, Homeland Elegies is very much steeped in the present, but it's going to read as fresh as it does today, a decade or two from now. Our staff easily deemed Akhtar's book to be this year's, quote, great American novel, and a masterpiece of auto fiction, that is autobiographical fiction. And when we say it's steeped in the now, here's an example. One of the most affecting and occasionally funniest narratives in Akhtar's book revolves around the complicated relationship the protagonist has with his father, an immigrant from Pakistan who once served as Donald Trump's doctor, which leads him to support Donald Trump in 2016. So kind of a perfect cover choice for our 2020 Best Books issue. But again, just one of many great books that landed on this year's list.
And once we are past Halloween, which is tomorrow, of course, the holiday shopping season gets going in earnest. We have some more sales numbers this week. And tell us where we stand going into the busiest time of year for booksellers.
Yeah, so unit sales of print books actually fell 5.1% last week compared to the week that ended October 17th of 2020, this to the outlets that report to NPD BookScan. Unit sales fell 9.3%, an even steeper fall in the adult fiction category, with John Grisham's A Time for Mercy leading the way with some 42,000 copies sold last week. But despite the week's decline, we haven't had a lot of those this year. Year-to-date sales are actually up a solid 7%. According to BookScan. And the previous week, the week that ended October 10th, showed a really solid gain. Unit sales of print books were up 13.4% for the week that ended October 10th, 2020, over the same week, or the comparable week, I should say, in 2019. Sales for that week were led by Ina Garten's Modern Comfort Food, which sold more than 130,000 copies in its first week, followed by Humans by Brandon Stanton, which sold 103,000 copies. So, you know, despite some ups and downs from week to week, and a down week last week and a big week the week before, and despite all the systemic challenges facing the book business, we continue to see strong sales for 2020.
And a surprisingly strong year it is, and it continues, but not everyone is sharing in that success. This week, New York's famed bookstore, The Strand, sent out an SOS, and readers around the country have responded.
So if you're a book lover and you spend time in New York, you know the Strand, right? It's a downtown institution with its advertised miles of new and used books. And it is a great place to spend an afternoon hunting for literary treasures. They have events. It's a terrific store. And I have to admit, back in my younger days, the store's owner at the time, Fred Bass, actually bought much of my personal library over the years so I could afford to eat ramen noodles for the week when I was an editorial assistant back in the day. Well, COVID has apparently hit the store really hard, not surprisingly. And last Friday, Nancy Bass Wyden, who is Fred Bass's daughter, who is now the owner of the Strand Bookstore since Fred's death, posted an open letter on social media asking for help from the local community and specifically asking them to buy books. And the reaction was swift. The call yielded a single-day record, 10,000 online orders, so much so that it crashed the store's website. Typically, the store sees only about 600 orders every couple of days. They got 10,000. The Strand's new Upper West Side branch, which is not too far from where I'm located on the Upper West Side here in Manhattan, opened this year. That store also saw a big increase in sales. But, you know, this is kind of a feel-good story, right? Because, you know, the people kind of rush to aid the Strand, but it's also complicated. And the reaction on social media was rather mixed. And my colleague Claire Kirk has a great report on the Publisher's Weekly site, and you can check that out. But, you know, there were advocates there expressing support for the store and another vocal contingency who were not quite so sympathetic. A lot of them who blamed Wyden for fiscal irresponsibility and for her anti-union history with her staff. And we can touch on that a bit more later. But it's fair to say that with the pandemic, Wyden told PW that sales were down 70% through September compared to last year. And of course, there's no secret why. You know, the Strand actually had to close for business on March 16th with other New York City businesses because of the coronavirus. It didn't reopen until June 22nd. And during that period, the store laid off a majority of its 216-person staff. Well, it's open again now with 69 staff rehired. But, you know, it ain't exactly, if you know the store, if you've been in the Strand, you know it ain't exactly an ideal pandemic shopping experience, shall we say. There's lots of little nooks and crannies. You got to wonder about the ventilation. It's an old building. And with this pandemic far from over, in fact, quite the opposite, starting to ramp up again, the future is still quite uncertain. In fact, even with all the recent support, Nancy Bass Wyden, I should say, couldn't say what will happen going forward. She called this a huge turning point in the store's history, and she noted that it's been in operation for 93 years. It's survived numerous challenges from the Great Depression to the advent of Amazon. In fact, it's the last remaining bookstore still standing from the original 48 stores that once existed on Fourth Avenue's Book Row. And make no mistake, if we were to lose the Strand, that would be a sad day for the city.
So as a New Yorker and knowing the Strand as you do, I suppose you have some personal thoughts about all of this.
Yeah, and I'll just say up front that I certainly understand the mixed feelings and I sympathize with the position that the Strand's employees find themselves in, right? Wyden told PW that the city of New York bears responsibility for the long lockdown and that New York City has to do more to help businesses. But I'm not sure that that analysis is right on. I mean, what is the city supposed to do? I see this more as a federal issue. Without a bailout for local and state governments, I mean, we're looking at a more than $2 billion budget gap in New York City right now. The coronavirus has hit everybody hard. You know, people need to eat, my kids need to go to school, and we still have to beat this virus. So, yeah, you know, we need help. We all need help, but I don't think you can put this on New York City, right? We're going to need some help from a higher power, namely the federal government. So take a number and get in line if you're looking for help from the city right now. That said, we have to save the Strand. It's an institution. It would be a tremendous loss. And all the workers who are understandably perhaps displeased with how management has perhaps treated them in the past, I'm sure they would be much more displeased without a job. And I'm guessing, and let's face it, if the Strand goes down, it's not going to be replaced by another bookstore, right? It's going to be a Bed Bath & Beyond or something, looking at the way New York City real estate is going. So look, you know, we are in crisis here. My feeling is let's save the store first, and then we can talk about making it better. At least that's the way I feel right now, with full sympathy for the employees and the booksellers who work there. Oh, and by the way, another famous indie bookseller is also asking for help. You may know it, Chris, Shakespeare and Company in Paris. And this with France heading into another lockdown. But, you know, that's France. And I have to say, I have a little more confidence that the French are ultimately going to step up and protect their institutions, including their bookstores. But something to keep an eye on as the coronavirus starts to spike again. And I promise you, one day, my friend, we will hopefully be able to visit Paris again.
Well, we shall think about that with great pleasure. Je rêve. In another book-selling related story, Andrew, the two-year-old legal case between Barnes & Noble and Demos Parneros, who was fired suddenly in 2018, has ended just as suddenly this week with both sides dropping their claims. You've been following the case closely. What just happened?
Yeah, so the bombshell legal battle between Barnes & Noble and its fired CEO, Demos Parneros, it just ended. Just days ahead of a pretrial post-discovery hearing with no comments from either side. And I reached out to both sides, and there indeed are no comments, which of course suggests a settlement and some pretty strict non-disclosure agreements. So, you know, to back up a little bit, our listeners may recall that Parneros was just out of the blue fired on July 3rd, right before the July 4th holiday in 2018, with only a vague press release that said his firing was for unnamed violations of company policy. Well, in response, Parneros filed an absolute bomb of a breach of contract and defamation lawsuit on August 28th, which alleged a real toxic environment fostered by BNN founder Len Riggio, who Parneros says was irate over the collapse of a potential sale of the company in June of that year and engineered Parneros' firing on false pretenses so he could retake control of the company. Well, Barnes & Noble responded with a countersuit. They accused Parneros of harassing a female employee, bullying a fellow executive, and yes, they alleged that the former CEO intentionally sabotaged a potential sale in June of 2018. So, as to your question, what just happened this week with the suit? Well, in September, the court tossed the most serious charge levied by Parneros. That was the defamation charge. Now, they left two claims to go ahead for trial. But the fact is, with the defamation claim off the table, that really narrowed the amount of damages that were going to be available to get in any kind of settlement here. Now, a few final points before we close the book on this lawsuit. The first is that Barnes & Noble is still named in the suit, or was still named in the suit. The suit, of course, is over. But this suit was really about Len Riggio and Demos Parneros. And in June of 2019, Barnes & Noble was sold to Elliott Management. And you can imagine that the new owners, Elliott Management, they just probably wanted to get this behind them. And another key point is that Barnes & Noble was a public company when this suit was filed. But they're now a private company, which means we're never going to see the terms of this settlement. And the last thing is that most observers, I think, expected the litigation was going to be settled ahead of a trial, because honestly, nobody wanted to have all of this dirty laundry out in public. But the sudden and very quiet end to this litigation leaves Demos Parneros' future employment prospects in question. And I'll note that in previous filings, Demos Parneros himself had suggested that the sexual harassment accusation against him, which, by the way, he strongly denies, has left him virtually unemployable. So without going to trial or without some sort of settlement that gives him any path to vindication, I think that's all she wrote for his, you know, executive career. But then again, in the midst of this pandemic, what job is out there anyway? My guess is that the payout for the settlement was probably good enough, and the prospects of him landing future employment in the current environment, well, it probably just made sense to take the money and end this litigation and not take the risk of coming up empty-handed.
And finally, we wanted to share the sad news that Daniel Menaker, the former New Yorker editor and editor of Random House, has died. Turns out, Andrew, we both counted him as our friend.
Very sad news. You know, I did know Dan pretty well. I haven't really seen him much in recent years, but he was always a great person for me to talk with. And he was a neighbor of mine. So actually, I would see him exercising in Riverside Park here on the Upper West Side. I remember interviewing him in 2010 for his great book on conversation. I had the privilege of editing him for some pieces we did together here at PW. And I still actually have a book of his that I've been meaning to return to him. He loaned it to me. It was Henry Hitchings' The Secret Life of Words. You know, I've really been enjoying the remembrances. It's so sad, but I really have to say today has been kind of a nice day looking through all of the remembrances of Dan, because he was such a well-loved and good-humored person. He was a true giant in the literary world and just a nice guy.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And my own encounters with Dan Menaker, including several long lunches, are some of the most cherished professional moments in my life. And that he took the time to sit with me and talk about books and publishing was a great privilege. I always suspected Dan had mistaken me for someone else, so I just played along and was forever grateful that he never caught on to the ruse. Indeed, at the end of one of those long lunches, we began to fight over the check as we did each time, and I persuaded him that it was my turn to pay, and he said, well, if you're going to do that, I need to do something for it. And I said, well, what would that be? He said, well, what are you doing next? And I said, well, I got a little bit of a talk to give to some publishers. And he said, well, let me give you a joke you can tell them. And so he said to me, what did the bookstore clerk say to the customer?
What?
What the heck are you doing here? And Dan and I both laughed out loud because it was really a thoughtful and incisive joke, wrapped up the predicaments of the publishing world in a few lines. Dan Menaker, we're very sorry to see you go, and great life, as you say, Andrew, a literary giant. And Andrew Albanese, that comes to the end of our program today. This has been another edition of Beyond the Book. We do it every Friday with Andrew Albanese of Publishers Weekly. Thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure, as always.
Coming up on Beyond the Book, the Directory of Open Access Books lists more than 32,000 titles from over 400 publishers. Scholars who want to see their work added to this free and accessible library now have a toolkit with answers on funding, identifying publishing options, and even contractual terms in a book contract. Ilko Ferwerda, director for the OAPEN Foundation, tells me how a global group of stakeholders from academia and scholarly publishing prepared the toolkit in collaboration with Springer Nature and the University of Glasgow.
There is quite some evidence that there is, let's say, a bit of a skeptical attitude towards open access among book authors. And the idea was that, the misconceptions, the lack of awareness, the concerns among authors should be answered.
How to publish an open access book. Next on Beyond the Book. Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center. Our co-producer and recording engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. Subscribe to the program wherever you go for podcasts and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. The complete Beyond the Book podcast archive is available at beyondthebook.com. I'm Christopher Kinneely. Thanks for listening. And join us again soon on CCC's Beyond the Book.